Hello, and welcome to Juno Beach and Beyond, Canada's Second World War podcast. I'm your host, Alex Black, Digital Projects Coordinator at the Juno Beach Center Association. Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany posed a double threat to Canadian Jews. The German dictatorship threatened the freedom and democracy of all Canadians. For Jews, it also threatened their very existence. Despite anti-Semitism in Canada, thousands of Jewish Canadians joined the armed forces. They served in a proportion comparable to that of the general Canadian population. Burdened by anti-Semitism in the ranks, a number rose to leadership positions, and many committed acts of bravery in service to their fellow soldiers. Our guest, Ellen Besner, joins us to share their stories. They served as liberators and witnesses to the aftermath of the Holocaust. Ellen Besner is a veteran journalist and professor at Centennial College Journalism School in Toronto. She has been researching and writing about Canadian Jewish servicemen and women for over 7 years. Ellen's efforts have culminated in her book, Double Threat, Canadian Jews, the Military, and World War II. As you will discover in the podcast, Ellen's research tells us just as much about Jewish culture, customs, and mourning practices as it does about Jewish men and women in uniform and the military in which they fought. This episode is a little longer than usual, but near the end, it includes some great snippets of interviews Ellen conducted with Jewish Canadian veterans. Stay tuned for those and enjoy.
Canada's war effort is a voluntary effort.
Five minutes into the service, we began to hear a moaning sound. And we looked around in the shadows were a couple of dozen Jewish survivors.
If the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
So Ellen, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So Ellen, could you please tell us about your visit to Juno Beach and the Bennie-sur-Mer Canadian War Cemetery back in 2011? And how did that experience spark this project for you?
We were there in July with our kids. They were young, on a tour of Normandy, not really knowing much about what was there, although we'd gone on a recommendation of a very famous Canadian historian, military historian and journalist, Ted Barris, who said, you got to go. So when we went to the Canadian War Cemetery in Riviera, Bennie-sur-Mer, many Jewish people visit cemeteries differently than non-Jewish people. We walked around and we saw the 2,000 graves, and it was a overcast gray July day, raining a little bit. And, you know, the magnitude of the graves is very striking. It's overwhelming. But we also look specifically, we did then, for the Jewish graves, the ones with the Star of David on the tombstones. And when we saw those, we, of course, do what you're supposed to do religiously, which is to put a small pebble on the top of it to tell them that you were there. We don't put flowers and wreaths because they're not permanent. They blow away. They fade. But stones don't disappear. They're permanent markers. And so we did as many as we could find of the graves. It turned out there were about 18 or 20 Jewish boys buried there. And when I took down their names. And when we got to this one in particular, the epitaph that was on it reached out to me. Literally, I was so stunned by what it said that I wrote it down on a scrap piece of paper. It said G. Meltz, that's the bombardier, G. Meltz, 25, Toronto. And the date he was killed, July 8th, 44. And below with a Star of David is room for an epitaph. And it said, he died, so Jewry, J-E-W-R-Y, shall suffer no more. And for me, that summed up basically the whole reason why Canadian Jewish people, and also all Jewish service personnel from the Allies, went to this war. Was to not only for king and country, of course, that was the main reason, duty and patriotism, but for the Jews who went, they had a second motive, a double threat, double purpose, because they were going to rescue their brethren, their relatives, the Jewish people, from Hitler's final solution. And so for them, this war had such significance. It was a race against time, and sadly, it was too late. So after that, I needed to know, well, how did he get there, who he was, because there's nothing in Juno that tells you anything really about who the people there are. There's no books that go grave by grave to tell you who these amazing soldiers, heroes were. So when I got back to Canada, I Googled it, and from there I found out not only did his namesake, George Meltz, live three blocks from me in Richmond Hill, Ontario, had also been president of my synagogue, but my cousin, Judy Gutman, who lives in Toronto, one of her best friends is also a niece of this George. Her name's Isabel Meltz. And my brain blew up because it was too coincidental that it meant something was meant to be. This was meant for me to know this and to start researching it. And I wrote about it. And from there, when it was published in the local papers and the Jewish papers, people started sending me their stories. What about my brother? What about my uncle? What about my cousin? And it became a flood. And I discovered that it wasn't just George. There were 17,000 and more who served, and nobody's ever written about them. So that's how it started.
You alluded to how the Jewish community kind of placed a different meaning on the war, even back in 1939, because I think Canadians, it must be said, in general, didn't go to war to save the Jewish population. Could you maybe unpack that a little for our listeners?
At the time when the lead up to Second World War was in the 30s. It was the Depression. Hitler was coming to power in 1933. There was a great deal of support in Canada for fascism, for Hitler. There were many Führers in Montreal and in Winnipeg. A man named William Whitaker in Winnipeg had a brown shirt group, and he published a paper where they had vehement anti-Semitic stories, columns, opinions, blaming the Jews for the economic troubles that the country had, blaming immigrants. Same thing happened in Quebec. In Quebec, with Adrien Arcand, who was a French politician and very influential speaker, who was urging people. He called himself, the Canadian Führer, and he urged people to boycott Jewish businesses, not to allow Jews to buy land for cottages or homes. There were, flyers on the streets of Montreal posted saying, c'est une guerre juive, it's a Jewish war. Basically, so why do we need to go fight for the save a bunch of Jews? There was lots of anti-Semitism at the time. There were quotas for Jews in many professions and universities. You couldn't get into medical school. You couldn't get into certain professions. Eaton's would never hire a Jewish person to be a salesperson, only as they could hire them as a tailor. Thousands were hired as tailors in Toronto's area near the Eaton factory, but no salespeople. Jews couldn't go to golf clubs or yacht clubs. They had to form their own. I mean, it was not an easy time to be a Jew. And Prime Minister Mackenzie King's government had closed immigration to refugees, especially Jews, from the early 30s and up to during the war, because there was one of his immigration officials was very anti-Semitic. When he was asked, how many Jews should we take? He said, none is too many. And there's a famous book that was written in the 80s about that. So the desperate Jewish refugees who were trying to get out of Hitler's Germany and trying to get to Canada to safety, and their families here in Canada were desperately lobbying and raising money to bring them over, they were blocked. You heard about the St. Louis ship, which had 900 refugees from Germany sail over in the summer of 39. Cuba was supposed to take them. They all had visas. When they got to Cuba, of course, they were turned back, most of them. Then the United States refused to take them in. And then, of course, so did Canada. So the ship went back to Europe. And of the 900 who were on board, 200 and some were killed in the Holocaust. And so Canada has never acknowledged its role in this racist and despicable act until May of 2018, when Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced he was going to make an official apology for this St. Louis. So that's why when the Canadian Jewish Congress, which was the political and social action organization, the main Jewish lobby in Canada at the time, when they realized no one was going to go to war to save a bunch of Jews, they strategically chose to change tactics. And instead of lobbying to save the Jews, they decided to take a different tack, an approach which was winning the war will be the best way to save the Jews. Therefore, we're going to mobilize, I call it money men and matzah, unleavened bread, because they also did religiously help the Jewish troops go with, you know, care packages and religious spiritual chaplaincy to win the war. And that was the fastest, they thought, and the best way. Sadly, they were too late. By the time the Allies liberated Europe, 6 million Jews had been killed. But that was the approach.
How did the Jewish community in Canada mobilize their efforts in support of the war?
Well, first of all, there were lots of people in the Jewish community who enlisted. And even before the war was declared, because Canada waited a few days after the rest of the Allies went, Britain and France, because they had to have their own debate in Parliament as befitting a separate country. Just because Britain did it this time in World War II, they weren't going to be doing exactly what the British did. So, but even before September 9th, September 10th, when it was declared, Canadian Jews went to the enlistment offices. And I know that. I've seen their attestation papers. I've seen the dates. Canada was only taking 60,000 men at the time, so there were probably way more than the government needed. But when that quota was filled, the first draft was filled, there were reports coming back that Jews were being turned away in certain regiments and in certain branches of the military. And I don't think it was just because they had more than they could use. From what people were telling their relatives, it was because they were Jewish. The Navy, for example, wasn't taking Jews. Just definitely wasn't. So first of all, there was a political organization called Canadian Jewish Congress, and they set up a War Efforts Committee. And it was a national body, and they did everything from raise money, Red Cross. They furnished all the recreation huts in all the military bases in Canada with pool, you know, with ashtrays and nice chairs and radios and entertainment stuff, magazines. So that was taken care of by Canada's Jewish community, which not too many people know, but I've seen all the receipts for it. Second of all, they mobilized care packages. So because the Jewish community wanted to support its men and women in uniform with kosher food, food from home, and, you know, religious books to help them feel that they were going there with a full stomach, because there just wasn't any provision for this. In fact, you had to eat bacon. That was it. That's all you got. So you either ate bacon or you starved. And so they sent boxes of cigarettes, boxes of, it was called comfort packages. And they raised tons of money. And women all across Canada, Jewish women in various communities, would every week, every month get together and pack these boxes with salami and socks, but mostly salamis, kosher salamis, which were delicacies for these people, and also Jewish books and material from the Jewish community, and saying, and send them overseas. And so they did that. They also tried to start lobbying to get Jewish recruiting offices open. So there was one open in Toronto on Beverly Street and one open in Montreal on Park Avenue, where they would encourage Jewish men to go in and they would help them with the paperwork. And they really laid on the guilt. I've seen synagogues accounts where the rabbis would give sermons and editorials in the Jewish press where they would say, how can you sleep at night? Why aren't you doing your duty? Get your children to go. This is your duty. Sons and daughters, we need to be. So it was really like laying on thick to get more Jewish people to go. Because one of the problems was, besides the fact that it was hard for Jewish people to get into the services, the Navy wasn't taking them. The Air Force was very strict on who it was taking because of the British, very, very, you know, colonial attitudes of only the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant people should be, you know, Anglicans should be in the leadership positions. We don't want Jews in the wardroom. And so they just weren't taking a lot of Jewish people. But another problem was that a lot of the Jewish community at the time, and there was only 168,000 Jews in Canada when the war broke out. So it's minuscule. It was like about a percent of the whole population of 11 million. But a lot of them had come from Russia, the Pale of a Settlement, where they knew what it was like to, you know, be persecuted. There were pogroms. They didn't like the Tsar. They didn't like the British even more because they were blockading Palestine and not allowing Jewish refugees to go to Israel and Palestine during the lead up to when Israel was became a state. So there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm for joining because they didn't want to help the British and they didn't like the Russians and they were afraid. They said, "Why should you go back in there? You just came to Canada as immigrants 5-10 years ago. Safety. Why do you need to go?" So there was that sort of whole parental and memory thing going on. But the community realized that, you know, they had to show their loyalty, do their duty. And as I said before, this was their war, if any. They needed to prove they were Canadian citizens. And this was how they were going to show it. So unlike in World War One, where because they were mostly Anglo Jews that were living in Canada at the time, so whatever Britain did, they were right there. This time they weren't so many Anglo Jews or British-born subjects. These are more naturalized or born in Canada Canadians. And so the whole Mother England thing wasn't as big an influence in the Second World War.
You kind of alluded a little bit about barriers to enlisting. Could you maybe highlight the experience of the Windsor Mayor, Lieutenant Colonel David Kroll, and his experience?
Sure. There's a few of them. When David Kroll was mayor in 1939 of Windsor, he had just met the Queen and King, who had just come over on a royal tour. He had been 2-time mayor. This was his second stint. And he was also the first Jewish person elected to the appointed to a cabinet position in the Ontario government. So he was very high profile. And he heard that the Jewish boys in Windsor were having trouble enlisting in the Essex Scottish. They kept saying to him that the colonel's not taking Jews. So Kroll, who was already old by then, he had 3 kids and a wife and he was mayor, decided that he was going to call up the photographer for the Windsor Star, march down to the armories and enlist. And then let's just see if the colonel's going to turn him away, right? And that's exactly what happened. He enlisted as a rank private. His wife said, "What, are you crazy? We have 3 children. You're going to earn $1.30 a day. How are we going to survive on this?" But he was, you know, committed to setting an example for other Jewish people in Canada. If the highest profile Canadian politician was enlisting, then they should do their duty too. The thing that I was told by his daughter afterwards, because he's passed away, was that the colonel made Kroll scrub the latrines and was very anti-Semitic to him. And even sent him on a dispatch rider. He was a dispatch rider, and he sent him on a mission where he broke his arm. There was a lot of anti-Semitism that he faced, but eventually he rose through the ranks and became, you know, head of the Oxford Rifles, lieutenant colonel, and was very, very senior in the Canadian Army overseas as well as home. But it wasn't just he that had problems. Even lower profile people, like a fellow from Hamilton, Alex Balanson. So Alex Balanson was a high school graduate in Hamilton, strapping athlete, very all-around robust guy. He tried to enlist in the RCAF. And you can read on their attestation papers this language that the interviewers were doing, which in modern day would never be allowed. It would be completely against labor codes, what have you. But at the time, they would write things like, "Will be rather pushy due to background." You know, his father was the publisher of a Jewish paper in Hamilton. You know, he was born and bred in Hamilton. He went to local high school. I mean, what kind of background are they talking about? It's coded language, right, for being a Jew.
What kind of, like, in the barracks, I think that's the one of the chapters you have, like, what kind of anti-Semitism did they experience even once they were accepted into the armed forces?
Well, it ranged from what we today would call microaggressions, right? Where they would say, "Oh, you know, you're a dirty Jew." Or, "Oh, why didn't Hitler get you?" That happened. There was also violence. There were fist fights. There were people that were kicked in the stomach. There were barroom fights. For example, Reuben Ostfield, he was from the prairies, and he was an instructor, an artillery instructor in England. And he ended up getting so harassed. He was an officer, and he had had enough of one of his co-officers that was bullying him. He took a bench, shoved it under the guy's neck, led him up to a, like against a wall and said, if you ever say anything like that again, I'm going to kill you. So the guy left him alone. Harry Hurwitz, who was a sailor on HMCS Athabaskan, another guy, an officer on, he was just an able seaman, but an officer said, well, you know, why did Hitler miss you? So Harry punched the guy in the mouth and broke two of his teeth, knocked out two of his teeth. And of course, the guy told the judge, they had a hearing, and he told the senior officer that he was just joking, so nothing happened to him. But Harry was put in the brig for 2 weeks and lost a month's pay. But he still, to this day, tells me that he would have done it again. Because you either fought back or you sucked it up and you took it. There was two reactions. But there was also issues with promotion. So on the battlefield, under fire and promotion, there were also problems. So on the battlefield, there was a medic in Italy, south of Cassino, and he was with the 1st Special Service Force, and they were under fire, and he was helping go up and down this mountain south of Rome. As you know, the operation to clear Rome and started down with all those big mountains that they had to scale in the middle of the winter near Cassino, and open the road to Rome. And he was under fire, so he tried to get into a foxhole because there other of his buddies were in a foxhole. And they said, don't let that goddamn Jew in. So his sergeant major was there and heard him, who wasn't Jewish, and said, if the Jew doesn't go in, I don't, you know, you don't come in either. And so he made them open up for him. He stood up for him. So there was all kinds of stuff, even on the battlefield. On promotion-wise, there were lots of Jews who went into senior positions. We had some of the highest ranking Canadian Jews. The first Jewish general was Robert P. Rothschild, Bob Rothschild, who was wounded in Normandy and ended up taking surrender in May 45 of some of the German troops. But some didn't get promoted because they were Jewish. You could never prove it because there were certain rules that said, you know, everyone's brave on, not rules, but kind of the way it was. Some of the regiments said, well, everyone's gallant, so we can't award everybody. But Lieutenant Mitch Sterlin, for example, near the gully and near Ortona, he actually should have been, he was nominated for a medal for holding off 40 Germans in a farmhouse until reinforcements came the next day in December near Ortona in Italy. And he was killed in Sniper Alley before the paperwork would go through. But people in his regiment have said they heard people say, oh, you know, he's overweight and he's a Jew. Why would we reward him? And Sid Schulemsen, who was the most senior decorated Canadian Jew in World War II, he had the DSO and he had a DFC. He taught the entire RCAF wing where he was in Scotland, in Wick and that whole northeast area, how to use rockets under his bow fighters to sink ships, because he was an aeronautical engineer, or aviation engineer, I should say, and he was an ace as well. He sank 13 German ships and shot down a bunch of planes with his bow fighter, and he was never promoted above flight lieutenant. And that's crazy. He was even called to, you know, teach the whole British Admiralty in that area how to do it, because they had ships with planes, shipborne planes, and how would they do it. But one of the admirals phoned up the base and said, what kind of name is Schulemsen? And the duty officer knew what was going on. So he said, Canadian, sir, but the gig for teaching was canceled. Anyway, so it did happen.
Yeah, that story about Schulemsen, yeah, that really struck me, because I was like, you know, here's a guy who's got specialized knowledge and he's got, you know, bravery awards to go with it, and the admiral's just going to decide it's not worth having this course because it's a Jew in charge. Like, that flies in the face of, you know, how we would operate today, but, you know, real great example of what was going on then.
There were more Jews, Canadian Jews, in the Air Force proportionally than there should have been. There was close to 6,000 out of the 17,000 plus who served. Why? Even though the requirements to get in were stringent in terms of education and in terms of fitness, and you had to not be colorblind and blah, 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 the Canadian RCAF, they wanted Jewish people in as navigators because they were smart. They were good at math. They all had, many of them had, you know, college, university educations, did very well in high school in trigonometry and physics and all that. So that was a thing that they wanted, Jewish navigators, and a lot of Jewish people served in the Air Force in that role in the cockpit. even though they wanted to be pilots, that was kind of discouraged. Although there were some Jewish pilots, you know, who won DFCs and were very, very rewarded and brave. But yeah, that was a thing that was very interesting. And there's been research done by a colleague, Peter Usher, specifically about that.
And to your point about Gentiles need to remain in charge, when you're made a pilot of an aircraft with a crew, typically, almost regardless of rank, the pilot's in charge, right? And so I guess in your book you make that point that perhaps they wanted to keep Jewish airmen, you know, out of the cockpit so that they wouldn't take on leadership roles.
You know, it's dumb when you look at it from this, you know, 2018 perspective. But it was a very, you know, colonial attitude. It was back from the days when, you know, the British Air Force, where, you know, only white, upper class, you know, educated people were the ones they thought would be better qualified to remain in charge during stressful cockpit situations. However, there were so many examples that I found about, you know, brave Jewish pilots who, one of them was Lou Summers from Toronto. He was a varsity football player. He was a journalist. He worked for the financial papers, and he was an award-winning student. And basically, you know, he flew his plane upside down in order to save his crew when he was over Germany. He sadly didn't make it through the war. He was shot down, but he sacrificed himself so the rest of his crew, you know, would survive. There's so many stories of that, winning DFCs and bravery awards.
So you've said that the Canadian Jews served perhaps disproportionately in the Air Force. I mean, there was, I think, 10,000 in the Army, 6,000 or so in the Air Force, even though the Air Force was much, much smaller than the Army. But how many Canadian Jews served during the Second World War? And are there any other facts and figures you'd like to share with our listeners around that?
That's been a controversial issue for years. Many people have said that they punched above their weight. The Jews did more than anybody in terms of the other ethnic groups. And a lot of it is pride. A lot of it is resentment that the contribution of Canada's Jewish community has never been officially recognized by the Canadian government in 70 odd years, especially when, as we've talked about, it was harder for them to serve. They had more problems and it was more personally risky for them to be in the pointy end of the stick, because should they be captured and discovered as Jews, their fate would be very dark indeed. Right? So they had a double threat. So the numbers were controversial, but the Canadian Jewish Congress actually counted Jews. They went and made their own nominal rolls during the war. The rabbis who were appointed or enlisted as chaplains, there were 16 of them during the war, in uniform, on the front lines and in Canada, wrote letters to every base and said, hello, we'd like to know how many Jews are there. What are their names? And in those days, there was no privacy issues. So this commanding officers just sent them the list. And they also scoured bulletins from, you know, youth groups and synagogue newspapers. And anytime there was a Jewish communal organization like B'nai B'rith or something like that, they would ask, okay, whose son is whose daughter? And so they counted them. And they made I've seen these lists, this poor secretary that had to type them out in the days before computers and the days before photocopiers, you know, and I've seen these lists. They have names and they have, so they thought at the end of the war, there was a final tally made up to those days. And they had close to 17,000, 16,800 and something. Plus they didn't count merchant marine. So I'm adding another 90 Jews in the Canadian merchant marine, because I've discovered that as well. And then there was some who served in other allied armies, and there were many who did not put down Hebrew on their documents. The Canadian Jewish Congress was very worried about this, because they were afraid the dog tags, when you had your identity disks, right, which were printed, had the H on it. And it's very dangerous for Jews to be caught with H on, you know, Hebrew on their identity tags, especially, you know, when you get captured by the Germans. So they lobbied the Canadian government to allow people to put OD for other denominations on it. But there was a report done for a Canadian Jewish Congress during the war, and I've seen it, where they estimated at least 2,000 other people of Jewish faith put down, or they lied, or they put down, you know, Presbyterian or Church of England or whatever it is, because they were afraid. And who can blame them? In fact, one of the people in my family is buried under a cross. He put down he was Presbyterian. His last name is Cohen. His parents were Jewish. All his brothers are Jewish. I know personally, because they're part of our extended family. But he carried a Bible and was buried under a cross and still is. I went to see his grave in 2017 in Europe. So there probably were between 16,833 and another 2,000 and a bit. So I'm going to say close to 19,000 served, because we keep finding more who served under other names, anglicized their names. Either way, the percentage of Jewish people of eligible serviceable age who went is the same, about 39 to 40% of all eligible Jewish men served in World War II, which is close to exactly the same as the overall general population of Canada for the 11 million population and 1.1 million people served, which is about the same. They had about 39 to 40% go. So I would say they didn't punch above their weight. They served in the same proportion. They just had a harder time. And because of that different experience, that should be recognized.
Absolutely. And what about Jewish women in uniform during the war? A number of them served. Could you speak a little bit to their experience?
Sure. My great aunt Daisy Lazar was one of them. There were 270 odd, not very many. They served overseas. We had also nurses, which is a whole other category. But why so few? Well, it wasn't done. It wasn't things that a nice Jewish girl was sort of expected to do. You weren't supposed to go over when, you know, it was unseemly. I could even go so far as to say that their morals were questioned. And the Canadian government didn't open service to women until 1941 anyway, right? So of the 50,000 Canadian women who served, Jewish people sent, you know, 270 odd. It's very, very small. But they went, some of them, for various reasons, which I think are so poignant. One of them, her name was Esther Thorley, Esther Bubis, which she was when she was a single, Esther Bubis. Her brother was one of the Jews killed in Dieppe. Meyer was killed in Dieppe. And so she was the youngest. And she said, when I'm 18, I'm going, because everyone else in our family can't go. And I think someone from our family should be there to, you know, take Meyer's place. Some people went because for patriotism, of course. Some Jewish women went for adventure. Others because their brothers had gone in. And some of them actually were among large groups of family members. So the Hart family of Montreal is a very famous Jewish family. They were the original 1760s when Quebec was conquered by the British. Their ancestors came over with the general Wolfe as commissaries or provisioners, you know, to supply the troops. So 12 of their people served, 12 of that family served in the war, including Miriam Friedman, who Mimi Friedman from Montreal, who spoke many languages. They eventually moved. Her family was in the jewelry business. They moved to Europe in the 30s. And she enlisted first as an ambulance driver in London during the Blitz, because they were worried Belgium was getting too dangerous, so the family moved to London. And then afterwards, she joined the Canadian Women's Army Corps, and she became a staff sergeant. And she's the highest-ranking Jewish woman. She was decorated, mentioned in dispatches. She was overseas 40 days after Normandy was invaded with the first group of quacks, and she was doing interrogations because she spoke five languages. She also was in charge of the personnel behind the lines in Normandy in terms of getting them leave. And, you know, basically she was part two orders, if you know what that is, in charge of that movements of personnel. And she was, you know, one of the most 6 years in the war. And how we know about this, besides my research, because I spoke to her family, is the Montreal Gazette wrote a big profile about her, that she had more experience in war than most men. 6 years on the front lines, under fire, in the Blitz, as an ambulance driver. And, you know, they put the story beside pictures of the Princess Elizabeth and her sister wearing the latest fashion on the women's pages, which drive me crazy. But it was those days, what are you going to do?
I think from your book, only a single Canadian Jewish servicewoman died during the war.
Yes, Rose Goodman, as we mentioned before, the daughter of the owner of the department stores. She was originally going to be a nurse, according to what her family was told. But she enlisted in the fall of 41, and she went into the women's division of the Royal Canadian Air Force. And she ended up in a very high position in Claire's home, Alberta, at the RCAF training facility there. And she was an adjutant in the flying wing, which is pretty big job. I've actually never really heard of another woman being an adjutant in Canadian Armed Forces during the war, especially for Jews. So she was beloved, and she was lively, and she was very involved in all the base activities, fundraising and what have you. And she loved being in the force. She just loved it. She was an independent spirit. Her family was very proud of her, even though they thought a little bit like, what is she doing? But they had raised her to be independent, and she was. So Rose was at a wedding on the base in January 1943, and she and her boyfriend at the time, who was a pilot instructor, agreed to take the bride and groom to catch their plane. They were going off on a honeymoon trip to the West Coast, and they needed to leave from Claire's home, which is south of Calgary near Nanton, to get to a larger center in Lethbridge to catch a plane for TransCanada Airlines. And on the way home, after they dropped them off, the plane had engine trouble, and Rose was killed in the crash, and the pilot survived. So it was a very sad story.
Yeah, absolutely. Just, such a happy day turned, on its head. In terms of off-duty activities, was the experience of Jewish servicemen and women any different, or was it very similar to that of Gentile servicemen and women in the war?
Well, I've read lots of interesting things about going AWOL. My father-in-law was AWOL, my uncle went AWOL, but I think lots of people went AWOL. So there was women, and there was cards, and there was sightseeing, and there was gambling, and there was drinking, and there was sex, and just like everyone else had, right? But a lot of the Jewish servicemen did their leaves or off-duty activities differently. They would go to the synagogues. They would look up Jewish families for home hospitality. They would go to dances to meet Jewish girls. They would go to Canadian Jewish or foreign Jewish personnel clubs, specifically where they could get a Jewish type of environment because they felt so at home in these places. They would look up the rabbi. They would, when you go to some of these people's homes for dinners, they had nice looking daughters. A lot of them got married, because that was what was done. And, you paraded the daughters out or you paraded the sons. There were lots of war marriages among Jewish people and war brides that way. My father-in-law was involved with one of them. A cousin and a friend met in Manchester on a leave, and she became a war bride and moved to Montreal. So, but I guess the way they would write home to their families about it or talk about it was very, it was different because, for example, they would go to a church in Italy, which you're familiar with, and they would look up on the wall to see the crucifix. And for many of them, being in a church was something they'd never done before because they lived in a particular life at home. So they would write home saying, "Oh my God, I saw old Yoshki on the wall." How they would call, Jesus. And it was like freaking out for them. They didn't really know how to cope with all this Renaissance beautiful art or, going to find a kosher meal. And they would talk about, so for example, Alex Balanson, he and his brother met in England for a meal at a delicatessen. And they would write home about how they were eating herring and all this Jewish delicacies. it was like the highlight of their life.
And then a number of them actually managed to, if they were stationed in, North Africa or the Middle East, try to visit Palestine. If
they had the opportunity. That was a very important thing for a lot of Jewish people to realize their dream to see the Holy Land. So Jack Feldman couldn't go because he was in Canada, stationed in Canada. But his brother went, Irving, in the RCAF. He was there from St. Catharines, Ontario, and Irving would write home about seeing the Western Wall in Jerusalem covered with, buried in garbage because the Arabs were, of course, pro-Nazi. And when they went to see it on leave, they were shocked at the condition of this, the most sacred artifact place for Jews around the world, totally covered in garbage. Others, went to the Holy Land and were inspired. There was a fighter pilot from Toronto, from the Junction area of Toronto, Gordon Steinberg. And when he came back from his malaria recuperations, he had to go to Palestine 3 times to recover from malaria because he was stationed in Egypt, North Africa. He painted a Jewish star on the nose cone of his fighter plane. I mean, other people, have seen nose art, of pinup girls and Hitler bombs. And no, but he had a Jewish star and he was proud of it.
So being of a minority faith in the armed forces, how were the religious beliefs of Jewish servicemen accommodated during the war, or did they have to kind of take matters into their own hands?
It's a great question. It developed, it evolved, shall we say. At the beginning, the Canadian Chaplaincy Service refused to appoint any Jewish chaplains to help minister to the needs of the Jews who were enlisting until they proved, the Jewish community proved that it had 1,000 men. Then they said, we'll think about giving you a chaplain. So that's another reason why the people wrote down like lists and they counted, because they needed to prove to Ottawa, that they had that many that were warranted a chaplain. Eventually, by 1941, there started to be the first Jewish chaplain, Rabbi Gershon Levy from Montreal, was sworn in as a captain, and he became the first one. And because of that, it started that they would raise money from organizations in various Jewish community, you know, organizations, and provide kosher food, prayer books, special prayer books for military men of the Jewish faith. They printed thousands of them to ship out. They had services in some, you know, bases, not all, because there were church parades, mandatory church parades every, you know, Sunday. But there was nothing for Jews. So the Jews had, at the beginning, even in England, they had to go to either the Protestant one or the Catholic one. And they weren't allowed to say no. And if they did, they had to get punished, kitchen duty, which was really, horribly degrading. But with more chaplains and more Jews and more understanding and more lobbying, by the time Wayne and Schuster, the comedians, were in uniform, there was in 1943, there was a policy that was sent around saying that, you know, no Jews have to go to any of their non-Jewish prayer services. However, kosherness, kosher food for people who were observant, that was non-existent. And that was a big challenge for Jewish people who were of, you know, religious practices that cared about this stuff. So there's a lot of Jewish people who told me, a lot of veterans, how they had to deal with eating pork or starving for the first couple of weeks while they're in basic training because they didn't know what to eat. Harry Kashansky, who served as a signaler in Canada, came from a very religious family, and he had a very interesting way of coping for a while with the dietary requirements. And here's his little interview. You can hear him talk about it.
The Army. I'll tell you exactly what happened. When I first got into the Army, I spent all my time eating Dad's cookies. I wouldn't eat. That's true. I used to go into the campaign. How do I eat? Oh, I live on Dad's cookies. So they, and often, you know, they used to, we used to line up for mess talks. So instead of my plate, I'd pull my plate away because I don't want their gravies and all that kind of stuff.
You must have starved.
Well, I had coffee and Dad's cookies I lived on for quite a while.
Besides the sort of inroads that intolerance that started happening within the Canadian homegrown military back here in Canada, overseas, once the Canadians went overseas, there were services. The rabbis had large Passover or New Year dinners, Jewish New Year dinners, where, you know, 500 men would come. They even brought unleavened bread, we call it matzah, to the front lines. In March of 45, there was a very famous Jewish service, which was held in Kleve, Germany, just before the Passover holiday, where hundreds of Jewish men from Canada were present. There are famous pictures. Why? Because the Canadian Army Public Relations Department, Film Department, was so amazed that Rabbi Samuel Kass wanted to hold this first ever Jewish church parade in years in Germany, because it had been outlawed before, that they sent cameras, and we have video of it. And the video was then shown in movie theaters all across Canada in the end of, you know, 45. So it's an amazing document to prove, you know, that the Army thought that once the liberation happened, the Jews should be celebrated. And some of the men who were there, I have interviewed them at this ceremony. They said it was the highlight of the whole war. Like, they still felt so, it was like giving the finger to Hitler. Like, we're still here. And, you know, this is why we fought.
Canadian troops of Jewish persuasion marched to a special service. It is the first Jewish church parade to be held on German soil since its capture. Men from all parts of the Dominion gather to worship. The service is conducted by Padre Samuel Kass of Montreal and Vancouver. Only 1.5% of the Dominion's population is Jewish. There are upwards of 10,000 Jews in the Canadian Army alone.
Yeah, so liberating continental Europe really had an added significance for the Jewish servicemen. This was the whole reason why they went to war, to try to save it turns out to be the remnants of the European Jewish population. But that must have had, I can't imagine the feeling of being back there, not necessarily being in time to save everyone, but saving some.
Well, I'll let you hear from Lorne Weiner. So he was a sergeant with the 2nd Survey Regiment of the Royal Canadian Artillery. He went through Normandy and then all the way through Europe, ended up in Holland and Germany. So he saw 6 years of war. He wasn't a particularly religious man. In fact, he didn't really seek out any Jewish kind of experiences while he was in the service overseas. He kind of blocked that all the way. But he remembers to this day, and he's over 100 years old in 2018, he remembers two things. One was when Canadians were on the road to Falaise in July and August of 1944, breakout from the beaches of Normandy. He remembers a service in the decimated town of Cannes, where the Canadians, of course, took the town and bombed it into oblivion. And a couple of weeks later, there was a Jewish memorial service in honor of, people who had been killed in the town, or Jews who had been killed. And Lorne went with one of his other Jewish friends who was in the unit with him. And he's never to this day forgotten what he saw. So I'll let you hear him talk about it.
So the place was piled up with rubble. Nearby was a quarry.
Yeah.
So Cannes is made out of white marble. And we got an invitation from the army, that any Jewish troops in the regiment that could be taken away from duty could go back for a remembrance of Jewish soldiers that were killed in the battle for Cannes. So there was just myself and a chap by the name of Johnny Windrow.
Was he from Toronto also? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we went back to Cannes. The rubble was waist high. And to make a road, they bulldozed roads. And a few thousand people were killed at Cannes. How we found this place, I don't know. The roads were bulldozed. Everything was flattened. But there was a building that had still one story left. And the Jewish ceremony was there. Rabbi Monson was in charge. And he had candles lit and so on. Now, in came some Americans, highly armed. I mean, we felt like we weren't really soldiers. Jewish paratroopers. I mean, we had guns. They had machine guns and knives here. I mean, it was a very impressive sight. All the more impressive for what I'm going to tell you. So here are all these armed troops coming in for this Jewish cemetery, and the service started. 5 minutes into the service, we began to hear a moaning sound, and we looked around in the shadows were a couple of dozen Jewish survivors. They had been hidden for 5 years, and not only hidden for 5 years, and only that, were still alive after the bombing of Cannes itself, which is a victory of itself. And they looked like wraiths, ghosts, standing against the wall there, and they were moaning, partly in elation. It was a mix of relief for them to see all these armed Jewish soldiers that it remained with me for many years. I couldn't tell the story without tears coming into my eyes. Didn't disrupt it, but it gave a surreal background to what we were doing. Like, we all recognized that these people were like, they were alive 5 years, maybe six.
What, did you ever go over to them and see if, meet them and help them, or what happened to them, do you know?
You know, I don't know, because we had to report back. It was a short thing. We had to report back to our unit. It was the one incident of the whole war that was highly emotional to me. I mean, you would have had to be there. I mean, it's not beyond description, but it's beyond my ability to describe the... it's like the morning mini. Unless you heard it at 2 a.m, you wouldn't know. They were like wraiths, ghosts, something in the... it was very surreal.
So the second story that would be something your listeners would like to know is, you know, what they did at Bergen-Belsen or at another concentration camp in Holland called Vught, which is between Rotterdam and Nijmegen. So it was a smaller camp than the famous one up where Anne Frank was in Westerbork before she was killed in Belsen. This is a camp for Dutch Jews, and then they were all sent to Sobibor and killed. But the Regiment de la Chaudière liberated it in October of 1944. And there were several Jewish men in that regiment, including Jack Markowitz from Montreal, who was a plumber, 23-year-old plumber. And when he came to the camp, the Germans had left quickly just before, so there wasn't anyone left. There were no survivors. There were no Jews there. But what he did find was storage rooms full of artifacts, especially prayer shawls and prayer books, you know, like just like you've seen when you go to look at, you know, what happened at Auschwitz with the storerooms.
What situation did these Jewish veterans return to in Canada after they'd seen everything they'd seen? Did their service make a difference in Canadian society? And how did they reintegrate to society after the war?
Well, I think much like the other million Canadians who came home, some talked about it, most did not. Some had PTSD, like they didn't know what it was called in those days, but shell shock or what have you, lack of moral fiber, whatever. Lauren Weiner said he suffered for 5 years when he came home. Every time there was a, you know, loud noise on the street, he would duck and tell his sister, get down, you know, but they moved on, they built up their lives, they got married, they started families, or if they had families, they tried to rebuild them. But, you know, some had definitely drinking problems and anger problems, which of course we now know what it is for them. Many went into politics, public life, became politicians. Barney Danson went into politics. He lost an eye in Normandy, the Toronto man, and then became defense minister in Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau's cabinet. They started veterans organizations. They founded companies, businesses. They became Arthur Hiller, who was from Edmonton, was a navigator with the RCAF. He became a famous Hollywood director and directed Love Story, which you may not know because you're young, but it is a very famous Hollywood story. They went into entertainment. And so Wayne and Schuster were big before the war. They were big during the war, and they were huge after the war. Monty Hall, he was a butcher's son from Winnipeg, couldn't get into the army before, into the armored corps, because they said, well, we're not taking Jews. So we went into the entertainment units, and Monty Hall became, you know, let's make a deal. So they entered public life. They became integral parts, partly because of how they served side by side with their comrades. I think that did help bring more tolerance and acceptance for Canadian Jews after the war. It took a while, though, for some of the discrimination in terms of legal discrimination with restrictive covenants on real estate or discrimination in hiring, that and human rights and universal rights. During the late 40s and 50s, those legislations started to become passed all across the country. Jews are at the forefront of that. Some Jewish veterans, too, were at the forefront of that movement. Yeah, the one thing I would say is that when David Kroll came back, Senator David Kroll, he became a senator, Canada's first Jewish senator. And he always said that serving in the Canadian Army during the war was no greater honor, because he now felt that he belonged. He was a Russian immigrant, came to Canada, came to Windsor, built up a practice, faced discrimination in politics, faced discrimination in the army, but he finally felt that he had proven that he belonged. Serving in the war for his adopted country was his way of showing that gratitude, and it was reciprocated.
So how many Jewish servicemen and women were killed during the war, and how did their loved ones grieve and remember them?
So we think it's close to 450 who were killed. One woman, Rose Goodman, and the rest in Canadian and Allied forces. The boys were buried overseas all the time, except if they were... One boy was from the American... served in the American Air Force, and they brought his body back to Nova Scotia. But the Canadians chose, you know, with the British Commonwealth, they chose to remain buried where they fell. So they put memorials up in synagogues. They put up cenotaphs. This is a common Jewish custom, is you name someone in the family, the first next child that's born after the person who was killed. Some didn't, because if life was cut short, it's kind of superstitious. You don't want your life to be cut short with giving the name to this new person, because it's a bad omen. And in fact, there are several cases where people, for example, Fred Pascal was killed in Normandy, and, you know, his nephews were named after Fred, and both of them died young, very young. So there's a little bit of superstition happening there. So they also donated scholarships in their names. They also put together, you know, charities for youth groups to sponsor things like Girl Guide Pack. In their honor, they planted trees in Israel. A lot of people did that, including the parents of Nathan Deluzzi, who was killed in Scotland. His parents planted a grove of trees in Palestine in his honor. So those are kinds of things that they did to remember them. On the anniversary of a Jewish person's death, it's a Jewish custom that's called the Yahrzeit, which means that on the eve of the date that they were killed, and so the 24-hour period before, you light a memorial candle and you say prayers. You go to synagogue or you say prayers. Some people put notices in the newspapers. For example, Nathan Deluzzi's family, his brother John, always puts for November 11th a memorial in memoriam about his brother. They do say Kaddish. Kaddish is the name of the prayer where you sanctify the name of God, and it's a special mourner's prayer that you say in services each year, not just necessarily casualties, but anyone who passes away, your grandparents, your sisters, brothers. So they do that as well. Some people give charity at the same time in honor, or sponsor a breakfast at the synagogue.
Yes, I have to say I learned just as much from your book about Jewish servicemen as I did about, you know, Jewish mourning practices and Jewish culture and customs. I actually really appreciated that. So the Canadian Jewish community, by virtue of the evidence that you were able to collect in some ways, has done at least a good job at keeping the memory of these servicemen and women alive. Why is it important for the wider Canadian population to acknowledge and remember their sacrifices?
Well, the Jewish community in Canada is still very small. So a lot of people are related to each other. They know, they've handed down the stories, but that generation is going. There's 50,000 veterans in general left in Canada from World War II, not just Jewish ones. I'm saying all veterans. And it's like the Holocaust generation. There aren't going to be anyone left to talk about what happened, what they did for Canada, for the Jewish people, and for the world in a few years. And it's a story that kids now growing up will not have no firsthand knowledge. Their great-grandparents will be gone if they're not already. And if it wasn't for this generation of fighters, we wouldn't be here. Especially the Jewish people wouldn't be here. We'd be all in, you know, gone the way, that's the Final Solution. And many of us came here just by the grace of God. We're alive. So it could have been us too. So why should the Canadian population know about it? Is because of the shameful way that the Canadian population and government during World War II treated its Jewish people. And yet, despite the anti-Semitism and the great danger that they faced, the Jewish community went to war, put their lives on the line, and lots of money, and did their part. There are commemorations of Indigenous people who served and Black Canadians who served, and they certainly faced terrible discrimination. But there weren't very many of them who went. And Canadian Jews sent almost 19,000 people over to, you know, to fight or serve in Canada. It's a very large population, and it's never been appreciated what they did for Canada. And it's time that after 75 years of D-Day, it's time that that was fixed. Veterans Affairs has nothing on its website about this. And, you know, Justin Trudeau has apologized to, you know, different groups for various things. I don't think the Canadian Jewish people want an apology. I think the veterans themselves are proud of what they did. They've never asked for recognition. They've always been in the shadows. But it's a niche story, and it's a niche part of history that should be coming out of the shadows. No one asked them to be in the shadows. They just always have been. And now it's time to know before they're all gone.
Well, thank you so very much for joining me. This has been, I think, really great. And hopefully this will also be a vehicle to get some of those stories out there as well.
I thank you so much for doing that.
That's it for this episode of Juno Beach and Beyond, Canada's Second World War podcast. If you'd like to access more of our podcasts, visit www.junobeach.org/podcast or subscribe to Juno Beach and Beyond on Google Podcasts or iTunes. I'm Alex Black. On behalf of the Juno Beach Center, thanks for listening.